Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your host for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Update on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other collaborative organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 698 participants on the call today, and you mostly come from the United States, but we also have international participants from Australia, Austria, Brazil, Canada, the Netherlands, Spain, Sudan, Taiwan, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program has been made possible by Pharmaceutics, Inc. and Janssen Biotech, Incorporated. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program and their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this program possible. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about the topics they'll be addressing. There also is information about our collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. Those are free resources that you can contact for further information and help. And I also want to remind you that there is an evaluation form and that we invite you to complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. When you think about it, you are our best consultants about the programs that we should be offering going forward. This is the beginning of a new year, and we are planning many programs. And indeed, this program today was one that many of you had asked us to do and recommended, and so here it is. And so please tell us what you'd like us to do, the topics, and we will try very hard to implement those topics over the year. Now, we have wonderful faculty on our program today and speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Susan O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is Professor of Medicine, Department of Leukemia, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. O'Brien is going to present an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. She's going to address standard of care and new treatment approaches, quality of life concerns, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Brien.
Hi. I shouldn't say good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. I'm going to give kind of an overview of CLL, and then Dr. Pagel will take over and also talk some more about different aspects of the disease. As many of you know, CLL is often discovered in a person who's completely asymptomatic, often because they go and have a blood test done as part of a routine physical, and they're found to have an elevated white blood cell count, and the type of cell that's seen is predominantly lymphocytes, obviously from the name chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Many people can be asymptomatic for years, not requiring any therapy and living perfectly normal lives, which is why we don't necessarily start treatment at the time the diagnosis is made. This is particularly relevant now as there's all sorts of new treatments coming that have just come or are coming that will probably change the way treatment is now commonly done. Some of you may get confused because you may get diagnosed by having a lymph node biopsy because you notice an enlarged lymph node. That's not uncommon either. And that might come back saying small lymphocytic lymphoma. And so frequently patients come and are confused saying, well, do I have lymphoma or do I have CLL? If the pathologist gets a lymph node biopsy and they have no knowledge about the blood counts, what they'll call the lymph node involvement is small lymphocytic lymphoma. By definition, if those cells are also in the bloodstream in the bone marrow, we now call it leukemia. So it's really more of a semantics issue than that you have two different diseases. The cells that are in the lymph node, if they were only in the lymph nodes, and that sometimes happens, although it's less common, would then be called lymphoma without the blood or the marrow involvement. But the cells look identical. Those are the same as the CLL cells we see in the peripheral blood and the bone marrow, but because the pathologist is looking specifically at a lymph node, he calls it lymphoma. So again, don't be confused. It's more of a spectrum and semantics, and there's really no difference between the biopsy report saying small lymphocytic lymphoma and CLL. Now, I mentioned historically we've waited to treat people with CLL, and sometimes that strikes patients as a little bit odd, like, what do you mean I have leukemia and we're not going to do anything? Well, there's a couple of reasons for this. The average age at diagnosis is around 70, although I've seen many people younger than this, for whom this becomes perhaps even more of a concern. The people can be asymptomatic, as I said, and if they're old enough and they have what we call other comorbidities, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, and they have slow-moving disease, in fact, there are many patients who may die of something totally unrelated to their CLL as they get older, for all the other common reasons that, you know, people get sick and die as they go into their 80s or older. So why bother to treat a person who is totally asymptomatic and where the disease will never cause a problem? Now, the flip side of that is that there are people who have their diagnosis made, and maybe they don't have the best prognostic features. Maybe they have some chromosome abnormalities or things that suggest, you know, it's not a matter of will this disease ever be treated. It's kind of a matter of when. Is it going to be in 2 or 3 years or 4 and 5 years? Note, I'm not talking about months here. So in an asymptomatic patient, even with what we would consider some high-risk prognostic factors, we're usually talking a couple years till the person would need treatment. On the other hand, if that person knows they're going to need treatment, that kind of leaves them in a very anxious state, just waiting for it. However, that is still the standard of care, and the reason we should continue to do that is that I'll mention we have new therapies now that are very effective and are clearly going to change the outcome of patients with CLL. And so if we rush into treatments too early, people may not have the benefit of that couple of years they would have waited to see where the field is going in terms of what is the best therapy and what is the optimal therapy. Of course, up until now, when people did need treatment, and how would we know that? Well, there are published guidelines written for doctors looking at when really should you treat a patient with CLL. And to a large extent, if you look at the guidelines, what they boil down to is you treat a patient when the disease is causing a problem. So very bulky or enlarged lymph nodes that are unsightly or uncomfortable, very big spleen that would be bothersome for the same reason, anemia or low platelets. We don't want to get the bone marrow to get so crowded out with CLL that the normal blood cells, which are also made in the bone marrow, your hemoglobin or your red blood cells, et cetera, start to go down because the bone marrow is so taken over with CLL. People often ask, well, is there one specific white blood cell count we should treat at? And really, there's not. And the reason for treatment can vary from a person to another person. So in some people, it may be that the bulky lymph nodes are the problem, and others may not have a lot of lymph nodes, but they may have important cytopenias, as I mentioned, their hemoglobin or their platelets are starting to decrease, and we certainly don't want them to get to a point where that person would need transfusions, and so that would certainly be a reason to intervene. We do look at the white count because it's an easy marker for the disease, but the reality is most people can walk around with white counts of several hundred thousand and even be completely asymptomatic. So there's not really a fixed white count. As I said, you have to kind of look at everything, the white count, the other counts, the lymph nodes, the symptoms that the person is having, and then come to a decision about, you know, this is a time when perhaps the disease is problematic enough that we should do something about it. Now, when people did need treatment, our treatment has been chemoimmunotherapy, namely chemotherapy, typically fludarabine-based, sometimes bendamustine-based, with an antibody, which is rituximab. And remember, rituximab is not chemo per se. All antibodies are proteins that are designed to attach themselves to a complementary protein on the cell surface. And sometimes antibodies by themselves can kill the cell, But rituximab is fairly weak at doing that. But what we have found is that it appears to be synergistic with chemo, so it makes the chemotherapy dramatically better. So most chemotherapy regimens, whether they're fludarabine or bendamustine-based, would also contain rituximab, and often cyclophosphamide is added to fludarabine. And these are good treatments. We can get people into remission that lasts for years with FCR. The treatment's over usually in about 6 months. It's intravenous. It's given a couple days every month for about six cycles. Each cycle takes about a month, and then people are done. But there are groups where this might not be the best treatment of choice. So, for example, patients whose leukemia cells have a 17p deletion or a missing part of chromosome 17 tend not to respond very well to chemotherapy-based regimens. And that's a group we've been looking for some time for alternatives. Another group where chemoimmunotherapy can work quite well, but where it can be more problematic to administer it, are older patients. And older is a little bit, as we all know, in the eye of the beholder. But I think for the purposes of this discussion, we can say over the age of 70, some people would even put that number earlier. And that's because older people do tend to have more complications, and the primary complication we see with chemotherapy is myelosuppression or lowering of the blood counts and infections from lowering of the immune system. Now, some of you have probably heard about some of these new oral agents that are in clinical trials. I'm just going to mention one, but there are several others coming or about to be approved. The one I mentioned is ibrutinib. Why? Because that literally was approved within the past 2 weeks by the FDA for the treatment of CLL in people who in whom the disease has recurred after chemotherapy-based regimen. And this is a pill that's relatively easy to take, little in the way of side effects. And unlike chemotherapy, where you want the white count to come down, but you also may wind up worsening the hemoglobin or the red cells or the platelets, ibrutinib won't do that. It won't make the other blood counts lower. It's important to know that the pattern of response to this drug, as well as some of the other drugs that are in clinical trials and will at some point be approved, is that the pattern of response is very different than what we see with chemotherapy or even just rituximab therapy, and that is that initially we see very dramatic shrinkage in lymph nodes, but the lymphocyte count actually goes up. And that's important to recognize if you're being treated with ibrutinib, because we don't want physicians or patients to think, oh, my white count's going up, so the disease is not responding, and then come off the drug before they've really had a chance to benefit from it. And these kind of responses where the lymphocyte goes up usually peak around a month into the treatment and then start to come down and come down slowly over time. As I mentioned to you earlier, most people can walk around with very high lymphocyte counts without being symptomatic. And so usually, unless we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands, this is not a big problem as a temporary issue. The enthusiasm for this drug is that it's not chemotherapy, it doesn't lower the other blood counts, and it's a pill that people can take at home, and it is very well tolerated. Of course, this is also going to raise other issues which CLL patients have not really had to face, although other cancer patients have, which is that usually most people are going to have copays for oral medications, and there are going to be issues in terms of how expensive or easily accessible these drugs are going to be to people who maybe have rather hefty copays on their insurance. The good news is that there are a lot of clinical trials ongoing with both ibrutinib and next generations of ibrutinib, as well as some of the other drugs in clinical trials that I'll let John mention to you, PI3K inhibitors, BCL2 inhibitors. There's a whole variety of oral non-chemotherapy-based regimens that are in clinical trials at this point, and they may be they are going to be very important for all of us, for the patients, for the physicians to gain knowledge, but they may be particularly relevant in people where the physician would like to treat them with a new drug like ibrutinib, but the cost would be somewhat prohibitive. And I think that I'll stop there and let John kind of take it from here, Carolyn.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien. That was a very outstanding overview of CLL and its treatment, and thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Associate Professor, Medical Oncology Division, the University of Washington School of Medicine. And Dr. Pagel is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, tips to manage complications and side effects, and nutritional concerns and eating hints. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Pagel.
Well, thank you, Caroline. It's nice to be here. It's certainly nice to follow Dr. O'Brien. It's always a pleasure even for me to listen to her. She's truly, of course, a leader in this field, and I'm happy to be involved with the call today. And I'll also say it is morning here, Susan, so I can say good morning. I'm in Seattle. And I want to just pick up kind of where we were and talk a little more about clinical trials, and in particular why they might be something to really, really consider outside of even the financial ramifications of eliminating co-pays or perhaps being able to get access to other drugs. So obviously what you heard already is that people have many treatment choices when they're looking at their options for therapy for their chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And that, of course, comes through multiple stages of your disease over many, many years. So you might get, as Dr. O'Brien said, chemoimmunotherapy, a rituximab-based regimen, a fludarabine-based regimen, maybe somewhat later again, a bendamustine-based regimen. And, of course, as you've heard, there's a variety of other agents, antibodies, and now we have a lot of these newer drugs that I'll finish up and talk about. But remember that all of these drugs that we're talking about went through clinical trials at one time or another. To get approved, you have to, of course, be shown through rigorous controlled studies, clinical trials, that these agents are not only effective but also safe. And to get to a clinical trial, you have to have considerable promise, meaning that the drug is worth looking at. We're talking, of course, about people with CLL or malignancy. So in the realm of oncology, and CLL is no different, studying these drugs in clinical trials makes a lot of sense. So I'll just back up and say just a word about clinical trials because they can be somewhat confusing for patients. Clinical trials come in different phases. We typically know that these drugs go through these phases all the way from phase 1 to phase 4. Phase 1 is typically a smaller study where we're looking at the safety of the drug. We want to make sure that it works, but we also want to make sure that we're not causing harm. And I think that's critically important for patients who have CLL. We know that this is likely a palliative situation. As you heard, people will live for years and years and do very well, but we're not going to probably cure the disease with any of these agents that we have at our fingertips now. That could change in the future, and I have an opinion about that, and I think it will. But we have to, of course, realize that we don't want to hurt patients, of course, with whatever we're treating with. So in general, the first rule of thumb is to make sure that we're doing our trials safely, and that's what we would call a phase 1 trial. I will say, though, that phase 1 trials for the individual patient and the treating provider, the goal, of course, is to get a good remission and hopefully extend survival and actually maybe have a major impact in the natural history of that specific patient's disease. So it doesn't make any sense just to test a drug just to make sure it's safe. It makes sense from a patient's perspective to test a drug because you want it to do something significant for controlling your disease, again, if and when you need treatment. Once it's proven to be safe, it goes to phase 2. That's usually a larger group of patients, perhaps in multiple centers, where we're looking actually to prove that the drug is what we call efficacious or that it actually really works and, in fact, holds promise. That promise would then lead to a larger, what we call, phase 3 trial, which is typically a randomized study comparing the drug of interest, perhaps it was ibrutinib as an example, to some other usually standard of care. So in clinical trials, when you hear about phase 3 trials, they're usually actually exploring a drug that has promise to be at least as good as a standard of care or one of the standards of care or perhaps even better. Of course, everybody would love to be on phase 3 trials. I also mentioned phase 4 trials are trials that are done typically after the drug is approved. Those are trials that the FDA may mandate for a pharmaceutical company to perform. Now, I went through the phases of the trials. I did that specifically to point out that this is how drug development typically works in CLL. But just because phase 3 trials may not be available, that doesn't mean that a phase 2 trial or even a phase 1 trial would not be reasonable for a patient to consider. Remember, every drug that leads to approval, including recently ibrutinib, started out as a phase 1 trial. And certainly there were many people who got ibrutinib in the very first trials. In fact, Susan led those and had significant benefit. So in this disease especially, I would encourage patients to, number one, consider clinical trials, and number two, not be scared off by early phase trials. That doesn't mean that those would be necessarily right for you, but they should be explored, and I would encourage that. So I often, and I think Dr. O'Brien does, and most people at certainly academic centers around the country, really do explore the idea of clinical trials as one of their treatment options. It's always a good idea, in my opinion, to ask about clinical trials. Ask your doctor or do some research on the internet in a safe spot. And typically the place I would recommend to go is clinicaltrials.gov. You'll see a long list of clinical trials there. If you type in CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, actually if you do that, you'll see that there's probably well over 1,000 trials that are listed there, many of them that are already completed. But it's a great place to figure out what might be right for you and to figure out where it might be right for you in relationship to where you live or what your doctor may or may not be able to do. So just to summarize that, I would say with regard to clinical trials, it's always a good option to consider them. And it's usually a safe option that may have a great opportunity to build on the standard of care and actually get something better than you might get, which is a standard of care. I do recognize, though, that clinical trials may not be for everybody, but I'll just mention that there are some really important good drugs that are in development right now in clinical trials that might be appropriate for someone on the phone or someone who's listening or may follow up with this. Dr. O'Brien's already mentioned, obviously, ibrutinib, an incredibly exciting drug. There's another drug that likely will get approval within the next 6 months, known as idelalisib. Idelalisib is what we call a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, or I'm sorry, a PI3 kinase inhibitor. It targets a specific enzyme inside the CLL cell, as does ibrutinib. It's got some of the same properties that ibrutinib has in that, as Dr. O'Brien mentioned, the white count can go up considerably with treatment, but that's okay. We need to accept that and understand that that's safe. And typically the drug can be very well tolerated. We do see sometimes a little bit of diarrhea with that drug. That's something, of course, to stay on top of if you're thinking about that drug. But, of course, these drugs are oral pills, and they're usually extremely well tolerated. I'll mention another drug that is in development. We're still trying to figure out the best place to use it. But another interesting drug in CLL is known as ABT-199. This is another pill that actually is in clinical trials that targets a protein that actually helps kill the cells. It's called BCL-2. The drug helps kill the cells by inhibiting that protein. There are a lot of antibodies in development. There's recent ones approved, other exciting ones that I think are coming down the pike, and including next generation of all of these drugs are things that we'll see. And so what we're seeing with these drugs through clinical trials is that people are actually having a great response, actually staying away from the doctor because they're able to not have toxicities for the most part. These are targeted therapies that people really seem to be doing quite well with. And that leads to this idea then about, well, how do you understand where to sequence all of this stuff? One of the topics I was given is how to figure out where research or clinical trials might come into your treatment options. And I hope I've kind of laid the groundwork for that to say that that could be at any time in your disease. That may be with your first treatment, or it may be with multiple lines down the road. And there's always a clinical trial that might be right at any stage of your disease. So research is important. It's also important, of course, for advancing the field. Remember that we do advance the field only through significant well-studied trials in patients, and the patients, of course, on the trials get the benefit, and patients subsequently, as they come along, science will contribute to the future patients as well. So that's my talk on clinical trials. I'd be happy in a few minutes to take more questions about that, but I'll switch a little bit to understanding, well, how do we, what's our focus and goal for treating these patients like yourselves, perhaps on the phone? And I would say that really, as Dr. O'Brien led to as well, most people are asymptomatic when they first get present, and often even when they do need treatment, they still feel pretty fine. So we want to manage complications and side effects by trying to prevent them from happening in the first place. And that's a team effort, I would say. I think that when I see my patients, I very much always try and encourage them to be proactive at discussing issues with me that they may think is somewhat trivial, but if they discuss it with me, I might find out that it's not. So I want to know, and your doctor wants to know, what's going on? Are you experiencing any numbness or tingling in your fingers or toes? Be on top of that. Are you having any discomfort in your abdomen from taking these new pills? Are you having any diarrhea? These are only important if you bring them up. Otherwise, your doctor may forget to ask. I hope not, but certainly it happens. And the best way to manage these things are, again, to be on top of them early rather than later. And then the last topic then, I guess, for me in the last couple of minutes would just be to say, well, what else can you do besides staying on top of side effects or what's going on with your body? Unfortunately, there's probably not a lot you can do, and frankly, there's probably not a lot you should do. Really, what you should do is live a normal life. Patients come in to see their doctor with CLL and always are interested, as they should be, to know what can they do to kind of keep their disease quiet. And I would say there's probably not a lot you can do except, you know, use common sense. Good, well-balanced meals. I would say it's, you know, of course, not smoking cigarettes, alcohol in moderation. And I kind of even get silly with my patients sometimes. I say, you know, you should make sure you wear a seatbelt and always wear a helmet when you're riding your bike. And I think the idea, what I'm trying to convey there, is you should be able to live a really well-balanced, normal life, and perhaps, hopefully, for the most part, only worry about your disease on the day you go see your doctor and have your blood drawn. Otherwise, I like this disease because typically I can leave the worrying to the doctor and alleviate that from the patient for the most part. I guess I'll turn it back to you, Carolyn, and that's my 15 minutes or so, and I guess we're going to go to Sarah at this point.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pagel. Very wonderful talk, and I have to say your tips are really important because I think people often focus on one thing and forget about that seatbelt or the helmet, all those other things that are really important. So that's really good that you brought that up. I think that's terrific, and I hope helpful for the audience to recognize, too, that it's there's a whole bigger picture here to be aware of as well. So thank you. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker. She's the coordinator of the Older Adult Services Program at Cancer Care, and she's going to be addressing with you the services that Cancer Care provides and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd also like to thank Dr. O'Brien and Dr. Pagel. I think we've gotten some really great information today. So as Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. I work with many people coping with CLL and also their loved ones. We've been talking today about managing your care, and I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care, and also talk a little bit about how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. So about Cancer Care, many of you know about us. You're on the call today. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, which we provide face-to-face in the New York area and then over the telephone nationally. We have support groups also provided face-to-face in New York and over the telephone nationally, and also online nationally and internationally. We have education programs, such as the one we're on today. We can provide practical help, help you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance, as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they're completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her support network, family, and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, so financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, psychological impact, and overall care. And I think adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is really an important part of managing your care and also an important part of the healing process. So as you may know, cancer affects the whole person and, you know, the entire support network, so your loved ones as well. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You don't have to walk the path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. Individual counseling really provides a space that's yours to voice any concerns that are coming up. And I feel very strongly that the connections really help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. You know, if you're feeling well emotionally, it really can help you better deal with the diagnosis and also the treatment. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the services we have right now that are available. At this time, we are providing an online support group for people diagnosed with blood cancers. To register for that group, you're just going to go to our website, which is www.cancercare.org. And then I also wanted to let you know about our other support groups. We have patient support groups, both on the phone and also face-to-face in the New York area, as well as caregiver support groups. So we also want to include the caregivers and loved ones in this, too. We have an online group, a telephone group, and a face-to-face group in the New York area. If you're interested in any of these services, you know, I mentioned our website. We have a very comprehensive website. There's a lot of information on there, actually not just on our support, but all of our programs, as well as information on your diagnosis and treatment and coping as you're going through this. You can also call us on our HOPE line, and that is 1-800-813-HOPE, and that's 1-800-813-4673. So, you know, I really encourage you to visit the website, contact us. You know, I think we've learned a lot from today's program. There's a lot of information to digest and kind of get your arms around. Our social workers here can really help you understand what it means for you and your family. So, you know, we're here for you. Just remember, you're not alone in this. That's really sort of the take-home message. And we're here to help you. So I just want to thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah, and wonderful resources for people on the call. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and if you would bring all of our speakers on board so that we can all be here to take all the questions. And would you explain how to queue up for questions, Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is open.
Yes. If you were treated with CF, what's it called? FRC in the past, and you need treatment again in the future, would it be realistic to you to recommend these particular new drugs, or would we have to go back to chemo?
Okay, I should stand for 1 second. Dr. O'Brien, do you have enough information to answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So the, historically, if people had a very good response to FCR, where their remission lasted 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and they recurred, we generally would go back to FCR because, number one, we didn't have a lot of options, and because if people had a good and durable response the first time, they are likely to respond again. Now, the second time around, usually the remission is never quite as deep, and the remission is never quite as long. But if you got 6 years the first time, you could reasonably expect to get a couple years the next time. Then people started using more bendamustine-based chemotherapy with rituximab for recurrences because it's not quite as hard on the bone marrow. And once you've given 6-FCR, sometimes it's harder to give FCR again because you're more likely to have problems with the counts in terms of tolerating it. Of course, now we have ibrutinib, which also becomes another option. As I mentioned, it was approved for people who've had at least one prior regimen. Now, people who've had more than one can also be candidates, but somebody who's had FCR and had a durable remission and has recurred could also be treated with ibrutinib and going forward with some of the drugs potentially that John mentioned that aren't quite FDA available yet. And then don't forget about the clinical trials. Again, I want to stress, as John did, that there are a number of drugs, including, as I just mentioned, second-generation sort of ibrutinibs, second-generation idelalisibs that are in clinical trials. Now, of course, they don't quite have the track record that the newer drugs have, but as John said to you, you know, ibrutinib had no track record when it started early either. So, again, participating in those trials allows physicians to really learn. It's possible that some of the next-generation drugs might even be better than the ones we have now. And, again, I think something that is important to stress is that when you go into these clinical trials, these drugs are all free.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Michael M. Your line is open.
Oh, good morning. I'm here in Arizona, so it's still morning. I have a question. I've been diagnosed about 2.5 years ago, and my platelets keep dropping. They're into the 80s right now. I haven't started any treatment yet. Once they start some type of treatment, should I expect the platelet count to rise again, or will it just stabilize, hopefully? Or I'm really not sure what to expect once some type of treatment is started. But other than that, I'm asymptomatic. There are no other – all the rest of the blood counts appear to be in the close to normal ranges.
Well, thank you for that excellent question. Dr. Pagel, could you address that?
Sure. Well, you know, of course, the answer really depends on why your platelets are low in the first place, but I'm going to assume it's because of the CLL. What happens, of course, is that these CLL cells are made in the bone marrow, and as you make those CLL cells, you don't make enough of the normal cells. And in particular, you're not making enough platelets in this case. And so if that is the reason for the low platelets, it's not something else, and it's probably not in this case, certainly, then, yeah, if you can clean up the bone marrow, in other words, you can clean up those CLL cells, kind of get them to go away, then you have an opportunity for those normal cells to kind of grow again and take hold. And your platelet count should come back to normal, so that's or near normal, depending on the treatment you get. But that's what the goal would be, certainly, and that's often what's achieved. I think the one tricky thing, though, is how do your platelets respond or how do you deal with your platelet count while you are getting treatment? And this actually may drive you to consider some treatment sooner rather than later in this case. So if you're going to get chemotherapy, those counts, as an example, those platelet counts are going to probably go down for a while. And if you wait for a long time before you get treatment, in other words, if your platelets are very low when you start treatment, you're not going to have a whole lot of reserve to get maybe some of these regimens that we've been talking about. So a lot of times that might be a trigger for treatment, and it's something to think about probably a little on the earlier side rather than the later side, and important that it's something that can be corrected, so to speak, with therapy. I hope that answers that for you.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Deborah L. Your line is open.
Thanks. I've heard a couple of different treatment options. One of the ones I didn't hear was ofatumumab, and I was hoping you could talk about that.
Thank you. Dr. O'Brien, could you address that?
So ofatumumab is another monoclonal antibody that targets CD20, which is the same protein on the cell surface of the cell that's targeted by rituximab. And ofatumumab was FDA approved a number of years ago in CLL, but it had what we call a very narrow label, meaning that the FDA approved it, but only in patients who had become resistant to fludarabine and resistant to alemtuzumab or CAMPATH, which was another antibody. So because of its very narrow label, it's not been extensively used. As a single agent, meaning when used by itself, it did appear to be a better antibody than rituximab. However, there's not very much data yet to suggest that in combination with chemo, it would be better than rituximab. Remember, I told you that rituximab by itself is a weak single agent. So the advantage of ofatumumab or any anti-CD20 monoclonal is that it won't lower the other blood counts like chemo will, and it's not as immune depleting. On the other hand, if you follow the label, the eligibility would be a very narrow number of patients. And also in that trial, most of the responses were partial responses, and they lasted about 6 months. Now, again, that was a very refractory patient population. So the single agent use of this drug is not widespread in the United States, although it's available, and we sometimes recommend it even for people outside the label where you really can't give them chemo because, let's say, they're starting, as that other gentleman mentioned, with very low platelets or hemoglobin, where chemo will make it worse. Of course, now with ibrutinib being available, that would probably, I would say, be a preferable alternative than compared to giving single-agent ofatumumab, because it also won't lower hemoglobin and platelets, and is a more effective drug given by itself.
Awesome. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Nancy B. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. I am calling regarding clinical trial information, and I am a reluctant participant of a clinical trial and can't believe I drug my feet as long as I did. For those that have the opportunity, I highly recommend it. I am having excellent success with ABT, Abbott 199, and my question is, I believe I am phase two, and my question would be, what is a typical timeline of the phase process before FDA approves it, and then what would be the consequences for those of us that are finding success with that drug once it is approved?
That's an excellent question. Dr. Pagel, could you address that question?
Oh, it's a really good question. So first off, I want to commend you for speaking up about how you should have maybe participated in the trial sooner. At least that's what I gathered from you. So congratulations on that. You must have you must feel good about that, and I think that's great. Well, ABT-199 or any drug in this setting in a phase 2 trial will, of course, likely go to a phase 3 trial, especially in this patient population, and have to be compared to a standard therapy of some sort in some way before it's approved. So it's got a ways to go. Typically, we base the phase 2 trial on how we would do that on some statistical endpoints. So that phase 2 trial will accrue or enroll a certain number of patients to try and achieve a statistically significant goal. In this disease, that's going to be a goal that hopefully provides some significant benefit to patients, or that would provide some significant benefit to patients. And that means maybe keeping your disease away for a longer period of time before it might come back or progress. Or hopefully we would see some point in all of our treatments that it might provide an improvement in how long we live. That's typically not a major endpoint what we're looking at in phase 2 trials or in this disease. But nonetheless, once we've done that and enrolled enough patients, have a statistically important endpoint that we've achieved and we've actually met that goal where the drug then shows promise, that's what takes us then to the phase 3 trial, again, where patients are typically randomized, and they may be randomized against a variety of different options. So what happens then is that the drug then gets approved, and the question, of course, also is, that, well, first off, that can take a long time. In fact, from the time that the drug's started to be developed to when it hits the market is typically in the order of many years, 10 years or more in some cases. So that's not uncommon. So it can take a long time from start of developing a drug to its approval. For the people already on the clinical trials, the beauty of that is that you likely will be able to continue taking the drug for an extended period of time. So just because the drug will become approved doesn't mean that the rug will get pulled out from underneath your ability to continue taking the drug. Carolyn?
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And we have a question with some questions about clinical trials from some of our online participants. So we have a question from Mary. Are clinical trials free to the patients, and are they handled through your own physician? Dr. Pagel, could you address that?
Oh, yeah. I think Dr. O'Brien mentioned this. I think it's incredibly important is that you have access to drugs, not only that you might not get otherwise, but you have access to free drug. So people that are on an ibrutinib trial can get that very, very expensive drug for free. That's a major incentive. The other thing I will say is that not everybody has a physician that might have a clinical trial in their back pocket at their clinic that you might be able to get on. So it's important to explore the options that might be reasonable in your region or in your neighborhood, or perhaps even if you're willing to go to a different part of the country. Sometimes people do that, and that's very appropriate. I would say I know lots of people go to see Susan in Houston, Texas, from far away because access to a clinical trial that they can't get from their own doctor. That doesn't mean that you need to do that. If you have your doctor has something just as good or perhaps better, then, of course, stay there. That's fine. I think the other thing I want to mention, though, about this is that if you're not in a clinical trial and you get one of these very expensive drugs like ibrutinib, is ask about patient assistance programs. They do exist, and they can help significantly with copays, and I would encourage everybody to ask their doctor or their doctor's pharmacist to explore that option for them.
That's an excellent point. I wonder, Sarah, if you could say a bit more about the patient assistance programs and the copay assistance programs as well.
Absolutely. So there are several different programs out there that can help you offset the cost of medications. And I'm just going to very, very briefly go over some of the organizations out there that may be able to get you connected to the help. So one of the first places, actually, you may want to look is where you're going for treatment. Oftentimes, whether it's through the social worker, patient navigator, and it could even be at the financial services department of the hospital, doctor's office, wherever you're going in for treatment, will have resources available to you to get some assistance. So that is actually the first place to start. I also recommend calling us if you're looking for referrals. You know, we can definitely help you locate, whether it's for CLL, the diagnosis, or for specific medications you may be needing help with, we can help you find those resources. So, again, I recommend giving us a call. Another, and this is actually a website that I'd like to point out for those of you who have access to the Internet, and that's the Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition. And Cancer Care, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and some other organizations came together really to create a database for patients to go to, loved ones to go to find information on financial help. And I really like it because it pulls up for you on the website both local resources and national resources. It breaks everything down from pharmaceutical assistance, general living expenses, transportation assistance. So I just find it to be a great resource. And that web address I'll give to you now. So it's www.cancer, and then F for financial, A for assistance, C for coalition, .org. So I definitely recommend checking out that website. And then I also just, when I was introducing that, mentioned the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. They are another great resource for getting assistance. So right now they do, I believe, have copay assistance available, so you want to check in with them for that. And then also they're fantastic for referrals. So if you're looking for assistance for any part of this, they're great with that. So those are some of the places where you can start to find that assistance.
And also the resources that that Sarah mentioned to you, they're actually in the materials you received from Cancer Care as resources for you to access. So there are a number of different organizations listed, and Sarah's highlighted some of them. And so those email addresses and the websites, the contact information is there for you to access. So hopefully that will be helpful to you. And there's another question from one of our online participants, and that is, what is smoldering CLL? And Dr. O'Brien, could you address that?
So sometimes people say they have smoldering disease, but there's actually it can mean one of two things. There's now an entity called MBL, which is monoclonal B lymphocytosis. So what does that mean? It's basically people who have a normal exam and on a blood count, a CBC, they have a normal weight count usually, but the lymphocyte percentage is higher than normal. So normally the lymphocytes make up about roughly 30 to 40% of the circulating white blood cells. A lot of the rest of them are neutrophils, which are what you use to fight infection. And when the lymphocyte percentage is high, the doctor may say, why is that? And send another blood test that will tell us that those cells are like CLL cells. But because they are so few and the lymphocyte count is not even elevated above 5,000, that really doesn't make the diagnostic criteria for CLL. So that's called, monoclonal B lymphocytosis. A certain percentage of people on an annual basis, a small percentage over time, will go on to actually be diagnosed with CLL. And the most common way that happens is the absolute lymphocyte count gets above 5,000. So in people whose lymphocyte count is 4,400, they probably are going to be called CLL in the next, you know, year, two, 3 years. And people where that lymphocyte count is very low, it may take years to progress. So some people never progress. So it's very benign. We don't do anything about it. It's not even full-fledged CLL. I think that's what most people would be referring to. In the old days, we had a terminology for smoldering CLL that it was sort of a little bit beyond that. So an actual diagnosis of CLL, but very little disease. But I don't think people really use that anymore. I think what the person is probably referring to is this MBL category. And again, that would just be diagnosed because your lymphocytes are abnormal and mark as CLL cells, but you don't really have enough disease to be declared CLL.
Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. What are suggested ways for coping with fatigue when living with CLL and undergoing treatments? Dr. Pagel, could you address that?
Was the question about fatigue? Is that what I heard?
Fatigue, yes.
Yeah, of course, it's a very difficult thing. I know that if I had to ask Susan what her most frustrating thing to deal with patient symptoms, it's fatigue, because it can be a major thing with the disease. And typically, it may not get tremendously better even with treatment sometimes. Now, the problem with fatigue is it's very what we call multifactorial. There's lots of different reasons that people are fatigued, including just the fact of perhaps age-related. If you're considerably older, you're going to be, of course, more fatigued than someone who's younger. So my suggestion or recommendation is trying to stay as fit as possible. I think that I find that for my patients, if they can stay physically active and fit, and then of course, get good sleep. Sleep hygiene is a major important thing with regard to fatigue. It's, again, getting back to the idea of common sense, right? If we can do those things, not perhaps drink coffee late at night and then not be able to sleep or what have you, common sense, maybe we can have an impact in the level of a patient's fatigue. I'd like to hear maybe what Dr. O'Brien thinks about that too.
So I couldn't agree more. It's very difficult. Sometimes fatigue can come from a number of things. I will always check thyroid function, which is a simple blood test on my patients. Because although people with CLL per se don't have abnormal thyroid function. That is a very common abnormality in the U.S. population. I'm not sure about percentages in other countries, but sometimes up to 20% of people in the United States will have low-functioning thyroids. So I'll usually check that. It's a simple blood test. And I couldn't agree more with what John says. What my experience has been, if I try and get my patients to exercise, they say, well, I'm tired. I don't want to exercise, and so, which I understand. And then I'll tell them, watch out if you do. And, I'm not talking about grueling exercise, starting out with what you can tolerate. 15 minutes on a treadmill a day, it's amazing how people who really are willing to do it will come back later and say, I just feel so much better since I started doing this. And it's not something intuitive, I think, because if anything, the patient's going to intuitively say, I just told you I'm tired. Why are you telling me to, go 15 minutes on the treadmill or whatever? And sometimes the other thing we have to look out for is depression. I mean, sometimes, understandably, people are really taken aback and quite depressed at the thought that they actually have a leukemia. And that often can manifest as fatigue. That's a very frequent symptom that sometimes is hard to differentiate from just being down. And so I always try and look at that, too, in my patients to make sure that maybe that's not the root cause of the problem rather than actual fatigue. So I couldn't agree more with what John said, though, about keeping active.
Excellent. Thank you. It was really wonderful questions and wonderful responses as well. Another question from one of our online participants to please ask the panel to include SCLL patients along with CLL. And so, Dr. O'Brien, could you comment on SCLL patients?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. In my experience now, where everybody's a little bit more aware of this, SLL by itself, and I talked about this earlier, where there's really no blood or bone marrow involvement, really does behave the same as CLL. And those people don't often have access to trials because many of the trials have been written for CLL. But I think we as investigators and the companies are much more savvy about that now. And, for example, with most of these new drugs, like ibrutinib and idelalisib, all of these trials and the ones coming are being written for both CLL and SLL patients. So I think that the person is correct that historically maybe those people with SLL had less access to clinical trials, but I think that's already changing.
Excellent. And last question from one of our online participants, which we know from the flavor of your comments already, but we'll ask it anyway. I was just diagnosed with CLL. Will I be able to work, exercise, and perform my usual activities? I'll ask Dr. Pagel and Dr. O'Brien to address this because I think it's an important question for everyone diagnosed with any cancer to always ask those questions.
Yeah, I'll go first, and I think I tried to touch on this. I think Susan did too.
Yes.
Yeah, everybody is able to carry on their normal routine with their daily lives despite even getting treatment. So commonly what we'll tell patients is that the only time maybe you'll miss work is the time you're in the clinic for the infusion of your chemotherapy or when you're here for your doctor visit. Otherwise, I highly encourage my patients to have a normal life. Work like you do if you didn't have the disease, exercise, enjoy movies and sporting events and family. And again, as I led to earlier, let us do the worrying perhaps, and maybe you might only do that on the day when you go see your doctor for a doctor visit or get your CT scan or what have you.
Excellent. And Dr. O'Brien?
Yeah, I totally agree. Fatigue is not generally, particularly in newly diagnosed patients or patients who've never had therapy, it's very rare to see a patient where fatigue is such a big problem that we have to initiate therapy. And again, then it's always confounded by the fact that there are so many other reasons that people can be fatigued in daily life aside from having CLL. So I would agree that activity is important, and most people who haven't failed a lot of therapy and maybe been exposed to a lot of drugs, et cetera, are usually, with rare exceptions, not having enough fatigue that their lives are really impacted. They may notice some, but then let's be realistic, particularly for people who, you know, have busy jobs and work long hours, who isn't fatigued once in a while? I know I am. So you just want to be careful that you're not overreading things like that because you have leukemia and thinking, oh, that's why I'm so tired, and not thinking, no, it's because I'm working 60 hours a week. And you'd be surprised how many people tell me they're tired, and I ask them that very question, and they realize what I'm getting at, and they start to laugh. Because, you know, just having leukemia doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be highly symptomatic.
Excellent. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been extraordinary today. And I want to thank all of you that asked such great questions, both on the telephone and online. I want to remind you it's a one-hour program and that we recognize that you may have other questions that you wish to ask. And please do feel free to call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE and speak to our staff here. Also, to access all the other services of Cancer Care, all the services that Sarah so eloquently described for all of you to take advantage of. As we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer, with CLL. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support. We're here to help you. And we're simply a phone call away. So do call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect. And everyone, have a great day.